Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner Chief Wilson Littlechild was not impressed with a Canadian delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Council. They were asking for unacceptable omissions on the renewal of the Indigenous Rights Special Rapporteur. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has reached year one of its five-year mandate to collect statements from victims of residential schools. Commissioner Justice Murray Sinclair says the path to reconciliation in Canada is a long road. The Aboriginal Financial Officers of Canada has recently marked its 10th anniversary, and in the future, AFO President Ernie Daniels would like to see an Aboriginal public service sector. The Far North Act has passed into legislation in Ontario, and the Anishinaabe Nation will continue its fight against the imposed legislation. And the mother of a former female inmate in Oklahoma is looking for donations of cassette tapes of traditional music for inmates at the Mabel Bassett Correctional Facility in Oklahoma. Glenda Deer says the music helps give the women a sense of connection to their homes. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The Sisters in Spirit Vigil is just around the corner. The Native Women's Association of Canada will be holding its event October 4th on Parliament Hill. The organization is also encouraging people to hold their own vigils across the country. The vigils are to honor the lives of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls and their families. The vigils began about 4 years ago. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has been up and running for 1 year. Justice Murray Sinclair, head of the commission, gave an update to the Standing Committee on Aboriginal Peoples on September 28th. Sinclair says the reconciliation process is not just for Aboriginal people, but all Canadians.
For some survivors, they're not in a position yet where they're prepared to engage in a process of reconciliation with Canada, which is not to say that they're not prepared to engage in some kind of a reconciliation process with somebody, just with Canada. And what I said was, in addition to that, was that there are some non-Aboriginal Canadians for whom this is not important yet, who have not been able to engage with this issue because they don't see it as something that affects them. And our challenge is, as a commission, to show to both sides the importance of engaging in a conversation with each other. And for the non-Aboriginal community who don't see this as their issue but see it as an Aboriginal issue, to bring home to them the fact that this is truly a Canadian issue and that they're part of the solution as well.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is under a five-year mandate. However, Sinclair says there are long-term matters included in the mandate, and reconciliation is just one of those issues. Sinclair adds the process of residential schools has had an impact over the past 150 years, and he says it could take just as long to achieve a positive relationship. He says the commission will continue to take statements from residential school survivors and their families. Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner Chief Wilson Littlechild was not impressed with a Canadian delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Littlechild says the group was asking for unacceptable omissions on the reestablishment of the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on the situation on the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous people.
At the United Nations, at the Human Rights Council last week, the Canadian delegation was taking positions to deny that we are humans, by striking out humans out of our recognition of human rights of Indigenous peoples, striking out fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples in a wording in exchange for the addition of an S in peoples, which is a debate that was settled 10, 20 years ago after an eight-year debate. And we're turning the clock back. At least Canada is trying to turn the clock back in that regard, and I don't like that as an individual and as an individual student. So I'll challenge anyone who tries to deny those rights at any level, any fora, especially at the Human Rights Council. When a state delegation like Canada says we want to strike any reference to human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples from a resolution that's going to be tabled at the Human Rights Council. So I think that should be a concern for not just me, for anyone. let alone Indigenous peoples, but all Canadians.
Littlechild adds the delegation's requests are an indication of the distance that we still need to go for truth and reconciliation. The Anishinaabe Nation does not recognize Ontario's newest piece of legislation, the Far North Act. Grand Chief Stan Beardy says there will be no activity on Nan's territory unless consent has been given.
The chiefs have already taken a position that consent is required for any business to be conducted with Anishinaabe. Consent meaning that the land users, the rights holders, the people that use those lands will have to get permission to outside interests to access those natural resources in the particular territory. So what we're saying is that by consent, I know the Canadian government talks about consult and accommodate, but the position of NAN leadership, the NAN people, is that consent is required before anything happens within our homelands. And I think that's the position we're taking, is that we will have to protect our own interests within our homeland.
Bill 191 passed into legislation September 23rd. The legislation is to protect 50% of the province's far north land base from development with intention to produce land use plans for First Nation communities. Beardy says the Nan community doesn't need the province to do that.
But we don't need Ontario to provide legislation to protect what's rightfully ours.
Beardy says it will be pretty hard for investors to come into Ontario's far north without the consent of the Anishinaabe Nation people. First Nations mothers living in Vancouver will soon have a place to call their own. The Aboriginal Mother Centre will provide support, counseling, training, life skills, and education. Media reports the new building should be complete by November and fully operational soon after. The new centre will include 16 residential shelter suites with a community kitchen. The 28,000 square foot building will also include a daycare centre for 16 children. Once complete, the centre will have cost $7.9 million. The center was made a reality with several different partners, including the Aboriginal Mother Center, Luma Native Housing, Builders Without Borders, and the Building Community Society of Greater Vancouver. Former BC Attorney General Wally Opal has been appointed to head the public inquiry into Robert Picton's serial killing spree. The Vancouver Sun reports BC Attorney General Mike DeYoung picked Opal for the job because of his deep insight into the province's legal and law enforcement establishments, as well as his sensitivity as a member of a visible minority. Head of BC Indian Chiefs Stuart Phillip criticized the appointment. Phillip said Opal had too many ties to the Liberal government, which raised questions about his objectivity. But the Attorney General dismissed those complaints. Opal is expected to deliver his report by the end of next year. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce is supporting a review of the First Nations schools funding formula. The Brantford Expositor reports a resolution has been adopted by the Chamber to call on the federal government to ensure any revised funding is comprehensive and equitable. The proposed resolution also addresses the issue of an aging labor force and shortage of skilled workers, and also identify that the First Nations potential share of the national labor market is expected to triple over the next 20 years. Meanwhile, provincial and territorial education ministers say Aboriginal education remains a priority. CBC reports more meetings are planned to focus on the education of Aboriginal people. Those reports follow a National Education Awareness Week initiated by the Assembly of First Nations. CBC reports a judge has dismissed a case that argued Edmonton jury trials routinely violate the rights of Aboriginal people by leaving First Nations out of jury pools. Justice Patrick Sullivan ruled on September 24th that the jury selection process is fair and that Aboriginals have not been systematically excluded. Lawyer Tom Engel, who argued the motion, said he wasn't surprised by the ruling. The Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations has called on the federal government to exempt Treaty Indians from the gun registry. That after the Long Gun Registry narrowly survived a vote in the House of Commons. The Leader Post reports all First Nations in Saskatchewan signed a declaration in 2000 stating that the registry violated treaty rights. FSIN Vice Chief Lyle Whitefish says part of their livelihood and sustenance is hunting and gathering, and they're covered under the treaties for that. He said the red tape involved for registering a long gun, as well as the potential for a criminal code violation, have been an unreasonable burden on First Nations people trying to fulfill their treaty rights. Meanwhile, the Chief of the Saskatoon Police Force, Clive Whale, said it wouldn't be feasible to have such an exemption under the law and compared it to the laws around vehicle registration. However, the police chief said he supports making the offense of non-registration a provincial summary instead of a criminal code offense. The One Laptop Per Child project has kicked off. The project is funded by the Belinda Stronach Foundation and will be providing about 5,000 First Nations children with laptops across Canada. So far, the Winnipeg Free Press reports that Nelson House First Nations School will be receiving about 320 laptops for the children there. The program now being introduced in Canada is modeled after an international program in more than 30 countries. The mission of One Laptop Per Child aims to create educational opportunities for the world's poorest children by providing them with rugged, low-cost, low-power connected laptops with content and software designed for collaborative, joyful, self-empowered learning. Hollywood director James Cameron has toured the country's oil sands. The director of Avatar was on a two-day whirlwind tour. Cameron was invited by the Alberta government and First Nations leaders. Time magazine also joined Cameron for his trip. Cameron has already declared the oil sands a black eye on Canada's environmental record. After his visit to the oil sands, Cameron has called on government to put the brakes on further expansion while more is learned about how to extract oil in a more environmentally safe fashion. Cameron also said he'll help with whatever needs to be done to protect the people of Fort Chipewyan from pollution caused by oil sands operations. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
He met his girl so pretty, so fine. He'd be dead before the sun would shine. Shot in the head for a petty crime.
Whoever thought that fateful day he would be killed that way? He lay bleeding on the ground, unarmed, no weapon found.
Kyle Tate's life cut so short, policeman's gun, ballistic report. No rights had he, the Indian boy, never again to bring his family joy.
He shot him and told him to get out. Raise your hands, I heard them shout. 14 years on the force, 3 paces away, 4 feet off course.
In short life, so hard, so fast, into this drama he was cast. 3 bullets fired and another boy.
Sweet, we're people too. We bleed red just like you. Kyle had goals and dreams and plans, but he never lived to be a man.
I went home and I hugged my son. So glad to see him. He could have been the one who died that night in a Burnaby Lane, never to love or laugh again.
They tried to give him CPR, arrested the others in the car. Why did you kill him? His girl cried. No one else to take his side.
A joyride, joyride,
joyride, joyride.
That was Métis singer-songwriter Arlette Alcock with Joyride from her CD, Wolf Girl. According to the Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner, Chief Wilson Littlechild, a Canadian delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Council was requesting certain omissions to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Littlechild discusses the event at a press conference. APTN's George A. Barrera questions Littlechild at the presser.
If you or Mr. Wilson Littlechild, Commissioner, could also answer this. You brought up the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights, and you received a response from Conservative Senator Carolyn Stewart Olson on this. I'm just wondering, how you felt about that exchange when she basically said you shouldn't be concentrating on international issues.
Well, first of all, I think it's...
This is a Commissioner Littlechild, incidentally answering you, okay?
Yep.
It's two things I would say. First of all, it's an indication of the distance we have to go in terms of recognition of us as Indigenous peoples and our work. And secondly, it's very difficult for me as a former student to witness what I did last week at the United Nations in Geneva, at the Human Rights Council. And that caused me to say, in a way, what I did. And I won't take anything back because I think it challenges the integrity of the independence of the commission when we're told we can't do things in a certain way by anyone. I think we need to safeguard our independence as well. And I feel strongly about the declaration because I think it's a framework, as I say, as a solution to build better relations. And after all, that's part of the mandate of reconciliation.
Could you just go and tell us what happened last week then?
At the United Nations, at the Human Rights Council last week, the Canadian delegation was taking positions to deny that we are humans by striking out humans out of our recognition of human rights of Indigenous peoples, striking out fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples in a wording in exchange for the addition of an S in peoples, which is a debate that was settled 10, 20 years ago after an eight-year debate. And we're turning the clock back. At least Canada is trying to turn the clock back in that regard, and I don't like that as an individual and as an individual student. So I'll challenge anyone who tries to deny those rights at any level, any fora, especially at the Human Rights Council. When a state delegation like Canada says we want to strike any reference to human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples from a resolution that's going to be tabled at the Human Rights Council. So I think that should be a concern for not just me, for anyone, let alone Indigenous peoples, but all Canadians.
Can you tell me exactly what happened? I've heard about this, but I'd like to get some details. There was the motion that was being discussed. What was the motion about, and why did they try to take the S off of peoples?
The resolution was on reestablishing the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on the situation of the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous people. Suggestion by two states who are co-sponsoring the resolution was to change it just by simply adding an S after the word people, consistent with not only the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but the new expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples. When that suggestion was put forward, Canada, along with United States, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, all objected. And it was Canada's lead then to say, well, let's strike off these words, human and fundamental freedoms from that title, which then follows up into the main body of the resolution. So in a sense, it's if you just look at it, they're denying again, like they have for many years at the UN, that we're human beings. Because if they don't deny that, then they don't. If they do deny that, then they don't have to recognize we have human rights. The fundamental freedoms is a very major part of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. We have, for example, sacred ceremonies that we do in our own culture, in our own languages, that we believe are fundamental rights. And that's a direct attack to those kinds of beliefs that we hold as Indigenous people. So when a state takes the floor and attacks Indigenous people's rights and freedoms in that way, by using a tactic that is old and it has been agreed to many years ago now as a settled argument. To bring that back up again is a giant step backwards. And for me, as I say, as a commissioner and as a former student, to tell me to reconcile with someone who keeps doing that is a very difficult proposition.
And we know that the government has promised to sign the declaration. But in light of that, what happened? How do you think this impacts that promise?
Well, hopefully they'll come to the table soon and indicate that they are going to endorse it, and endorse it in a way that we've called for and others have called for, in an unqualified manner. What they keep saying to Canadians is that their proposal has to be consistent with constitutional law of Canada. Well, we've got over 100 legal experts who signed a legal opinion that it's consistent with the Constitution of Canada. So we've got Article 46 of the Declaration that balances the rights with third parties, third-party interests in Canada and elsewhere. So there's enough qualifications in the Declaration now, after 22 years of debate, that it's time to move forward. This would be a great act of reconciliation if the Canadian government would do that.
That was Truth and Reconciliation Commissioner Chief Wilson Littlechild. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has just completed 1 year of its work out of its 5-year mandate. The commission has been busy gathering statements from victims of residential schools and held its first annual event. Justice Murray Sinclair heads the commission and provided an update to media after he updated the Standing Committee on Aboriginal Affairs.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commissioners were at the Senate this morning, and we had an opportunity for the commissioners to present to the members of the Senate who are looking into, they're members of the Senate Committee on Aboriginal Affairs, who are looking into the progress of matters since the date of the apology. We spent time talking to the members of the Senate about the work of the commission, what we've been doing, and generally about the mandate issues and the issues as we see them that the commission continues to face. So that's essentially all that I wanted to indicate at the outset. We also were present when the Assembly of First National Council and the Inuit Tapir-Tekatami made their presentation, so that we were able to hear what their comments were as well. And we spent a considerable amount of time responding to questions from the senators and informing them about some of the issues that they were concerned about as well.
Hi, actually, it's Hillary Bird from CKLB that we're both here. I just have a question. I was just wondering if you think you're going to need to extend your 5-year mandate?
I think what we need to do as a commission is to identify those issues that are going to take a lot longer than 5 years to address. This is Justice Sinclair, incidentally. I think we need to identify for the parties to the settlement agreement what those issues are that are going to take longer than they anticipated. We need to keep in mind that the mandate of the commission was given to us by the parties to the settlement agreement and supported by the courts. This is not a mandate that was given to us by the federal government. So we don't need to convince the federal government about the issues surrounding the mandate. We need to engage in a discussion around the mandate questions with all of the parties. And that includes the churches, the survivors, and the Aboriginal organizations. excuse me. And then I think we need to go back to, if there are amendments to the mandate that are required, then we need to go back to the courts and get the courts to endorse any changes to the settlement agreement. But the issues around the mandate are that when you look at the mandate of the TRC that's set out in the schedule to the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement, there are matters in there that are very long term, and reconciliation is one of them. Establishing and completing a reconciliation process within 5 years is an impossibility, and we need to talk realistically with the parties about what we can achieve in 5 years, and then to talk about what needs to be put in place so that the reconciliation initiatives that we put in place as a commission can continue after we have left. In the presentation we did this morning, the one thing I pointed out was that the process of the residential schools and the impact it's had upon the lives of Canadians took about 150 years of seven generations of people. And it's going to take us that long, maybe longer, and that many generations of people, maybe more, in order to achieve a relationship that is bound by and in which both sides or all sides feel that they have achieved the kind of relationship that they want. So there is a number of other issues in our mandate that we also realistically need to talk about into the future. One is the issue of statement gathering. We have about 100,000 survivors to gather statements from. Some of them are not ready yet and may want to defer their statement gathering to a later point when they feel more ready. And so we have to allow for that. And we may not be able to accomplish that within our term. We need to talk about how those statements can continue to be recorded after the commission has ended. We also need to talk about the establishment of the National Research Center, because once the National Research Center is established, then the terms of reference for the center need to be put in place, and that's going to be another long-term legacy issue. So there's a number of things about the TRC's mandate that are intended to survive the commission, and we need to talk about what we can do within the 5 years that we have been given, four of which are left for us, in order to ensure that those things happen. So whether or not that calls for an extension of the term of the commission or our appointments is entirely up to the parties. We're not lobbying for an extension. What we are saying is that if you want some of this work to be done properly, you have to consider how it's going to be done beyond the five-year period. And the parties are the ones that are going to have to work that out, because this is their agreement.
That was Justice Murray Sinclair, Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada head commissioner. Now here's Kimberly Dawn with Bone Digger from her album Healing Jane. Aboriginal Financial Officers of Canada has recently marked its 10th anniversary. AFO President and CEO Ernie Daniels discusses what the AFO does and what direction he would like to see the organization head into over the next 10 years. The interview is courtesy of Nation Talk, and Daniels speaks with Nation Talk's Peter Jensen.
Ernie, can you demystify, I guess, for some of the folks who might not be familiar with the work and the acronym, exactly what the association does and what's your mandate?
Well, first and foremost, we're a membership organization. We're a professional association, similar to other type of professional associations. The AFOA stands for the Aboriginal Financial Officers Association. This is our 10th year in existence. It's been a short 10 years, but throughout that that period, we had achieved many successes, and most of it's based upon our members and also our partnerships. We have significant partners that we developed in the early years that really made the organization very credible in terms of providing a base of education with a national recognition and a certification process for educating financial officers through a number of competencies that are required to work in our communities.
Okay, very good. And do those partnerships continue today? And is, I guess, a lot of the focus educational?
Yes, we're primarily an educational institution. We're recognized as that. Our primary focus is on building capacity. So the type of partnerships that we attract and that we prefer to attract or have that capacity element and share the same focus that we do. Our long-standing partnership is with CGA Canada. Our educational program, the AFM program, which is the Aboriginal Financial Management Program, is based on the CGA program. So it allows our members to take courses probably anywhere in the country that have recognition, national recognition, and are recognized by CGA Canada, which is a very old institution that's legislated to government.
What, I guess, are some of the challenges that you find folks facing in the communities and on a national scale?
The challenges, it's kind of interesting. The challenges that were 10 years ago are still here today, and it's building that capacity, having the access to that capacity. And by that I mean there's not a lot of funding given to organizations to help develop the capacity within the organizations. There's still that lack of resources, financial resources, to enable staff to develop the capacity that's required. So we experience that with our members right now, and we try to ensure that our membership fees don't get out of hand. We also try to make sure that the material, the courses that we're developing are affordable to our members. So keeping that in mind, we do rely on outside financial resources to help us meet those ends. We look for corporate sponsorship donations. We look for in-kind services from other professional associations. We go to government when we can and where we can, and I know it's a challenge at the community level for some communities to be able to afford for their people to attend events like this and to take courses and enroll in other courses, and let alone take the time to do it. So that's the challenge that we have. And one of the other challenges is the finance person is a very, very busy person in the band office. Sometimes they're doing more than one job. Sometimes they're the human resource person. Sometimes they're the band manager. Sometimes they're the program manager and the IT person, and rolling that up into one. And it's a very challenging position. So what we try to do is try to provide the capacity, the knowledge, and the skills that they need to do those type of jobs. So we don't primarily focus on financial accounting. We focus on some of the other stuff, too, that helps them do other aspects that's required in their organizations.
Right. Related to financial literacy, I guess, and whatnot.
Relating to financial literacy, human resource stuff, being up to date on labor codes, labor standards. It's really important. And information technology is record keeping.
Where would you like to be? Where do you think the country as a whole and the association particularly, what would you like to see happen, transpire over the next 10 years?
I'd like to see an effective Aboriginal public service built up. Right now, when you think about it, in municipal governments, provincial governments, even the federal government, they have a public sector service of individuals, expertise, and qualified people that enable them to do the jobs, help support the governance structures that are in place. Chief and council can't do everything. So we need those expertise to be able to be self-sufficient. And I think building that capacity, because right now there's a huge capacity gap. We've been at this for 10 years, and there's other forms, other institutions that are being built up to address other elements that are required. For instance, in housing managers, health managers, those type of professions will be built up over time, and also the complexity of transactions that a lot of First Nations are being involved in now, with treaty land entitlement monies coming, lands that are coming on, different legislation that's passed by federal government requires another level of expertise. So we're catching up, but then there's another level that comes on board, and it's really trying to keep on top of that and to provide the capacity that's needed, because you really need that. Without education, without the skills and the knowledge to do the job that's required effectively for ourselves, it becomes very difficult without having that capacity in place. I know that there are some organizations, institution, and government is looking at some level of standard for operating in our governments and our communities, and I think that we must have control of that. We must have control of setting that standard ourselves, and supporting the capacity training that's required to bring people up to the standard. It's not going to happen overnight. In 10 years, if we are halfway there, I think we've made great strides. And I think that there are examples out there where it exists, and we just need to make sure everybody else is catching up. We can't forget about anybody. We have to work for everybody. That's what we have to do.
That was Ernie Daniels, President and CEO of the Aboriginal Financial Officers of Canada, and he spoke with Peter Jensen with Nation Talk. Ontario's Far North Act is now officially legislation, but that's not stopping the Anishinaabe Aski Nation from opposing it. Grand Chief Stan Beardy says they won't stop fighting the imposed provincial legislation in Nan's traditional territory.
We're very disappointed. We're very disappointed that for one whole year, we tried to communicate to Ontario government that we had concerns with 191. The concerns we have is that 191 does not give us the ability to have a say on what happens on our homeland, whether it's protected or what areas, but definitely what will be available in the future for development. So it takes away our ability to make decisions for ourselves within our homeland. We're still opposed. The position the chief has taken is that we will have a hard time accepting that legislation. It's a provincial legislation. We do have our Aboriginal rights that are recognized within the Canadian Constitution. And I think what needs to happen then is that we will have to assert our inherent rights on our homeland.
So what does that mean by asserting your rights? Are you going to take a civil action, or are you going to take this whole matter to court?
Well, I guess on a short term, the chiefs have already taken a position that consent is required for any business to be conducted with Anishinaabe. Consent meaning that the land users, the rights holders, the people that use those lands will have to get permission to outside interests to access those natural resources in the particular territory. So what we're saying is that by consent, I know the Canadian government talks about consult and accommodate, but the position of NAN leadership, the NAN people, is that consent is required before anything happens within our homelands. And I think that's the position we're taking, is that we will have to protect our own interests within our homeland.
Now, we know that the Ontario's Far North Act covers 225,000 kilometres. And when you're talking about your homelands, what territory does that cover?
10,000 square miles, 35 million hectares. So we're talking about land mass of two-thirds of Ontario. Within that land mass, we have two treaties. Treaty number 9 that was signed in 1905-1906 and Treaty 5 Ontario site that was signed in 1910. So we have international status in that we made treaty with another sovereign nation, the British Crown. So that gives us the recognition that we are a nation. And we never gave up the right to govern ourselves, neither did we give up our title to our homeland.
But it seems that Ontario is ignoring that altogether.
Yeah, definitely. That's where we have concerns, because we're talking about provincial legislation that's been imposed on us. We're not against development, but of course, for the last 10,000 years, it's been a priority to protect horses, and we'll continue to do that. But we don't need Ontario to legislate to provide legislation to protect what's rightfully ours.
And since First Nations fall under federal jurisdiction, where was the federal government in all of this?
I think we signed the treaty with the Crown. Our understanding is that it's the Canadian government under their constitution that has responsibility obligations to make sure that the treaty is respected as per Constitution Section 35. And we ask ourselves, where is Canada? Canada is supposed to be protecting our interests to make sure that the Canadian Constitution is respected.
So I know before the legislation was pushed through that you had the support of the local chambers of commerce as well as the municipalities. And is that support still there? And are you going to have any more dialogue with them?
Yeah, definitely. We had hope that living in Ontario, being part of the Canadian Confederation, being part of the Canadian society, that we would be accommodated somehow to make sure that our wishes are incorporated into whatever planning process there was, whether it's legislation or planning on the ground. Unfortunately, Ontario ignored us completely. So what this means, especially the large protected area, is that economic development will be denied those economic opportunities, along with municipalities and chamber of commerce. So I think it becomes very crucial, important that we work more closely with the northern municipalities and chamber of commerce, because we're talking about the economy here and the quality of life for all of us, not only people, but other Ontarians as well.
With the recent HST issue, and that was turned back around by First Nations in the province, how hopeful are you that you can win this fight about the Ontario's Far North Act?
Well, I guess what will come down to is that right now the area, we're talking about two-thirds of Ontario, 55 million hectares, it's got tremendous potential for wealth creation. And if Ontario thinks that, you know, they can just come in and start taking our resource out, that's where we will have to have direct action when that happens. I think what we're saying, the messages we'll be sending out to the world, to the multinationals, is that we're going to be very hard to find quality investors to access and create a wealth that is required, because the Ontario government is talking about the upturn of the economy. What they're talking about is accessing our resources in the far north, and without our participation, that's going to be pretty hard to do.
That was Stan Beardy, Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation in Northern Ontario. Now here's Digawolf with The North from their CD, Distant Morning Star.
Winter nights over winter cold, the moon reflects off the snow. Drum dance tonight beneath the moonlight, yeah. This is where I was born. West outside my cave, Highway 3.
Sue Deer is looking for donations of traditional Aboriginal music to help the women inmates at the Maple Basset Correctional Facility in Oklahoma. The Music Library Project is something close to her own heart after her daughter landed in prison. And the music, she says, is important for the women there because when they listen to the music from their nation or tribe, it gives them a sense of connection to home.
I have a young daughter who's 24 years old now, but when my daughter graduated from high school, when she turned 18, she went out partying with some of her friends after graduation, and my daughter got into a fight with a non-Indian girl, but the police were called, and they ended up pepper spraying my daughter when it was in her eyes, she had her eyes closed, and it rolled down in her mouth, and she was spitting, you know, to get it out of her mouth. Well, she couldn't see where she was spitting, but she ended up spitting on two police officers. They charged her along with assault on an officer, placing bodily fluid on an officer, and I'm not sure what the third charge was. It was something petty. But my daughter ended up going to prison for 2 years. She was found guilty. We went with had to go with a court-appointed attorney because we didn't have the money to get an attorney. And she ended up in Mabel Bassett Correctional Facility, which is a maximum security prison here in Oklahoma for women. And along the way, in many, many visits, I got to know a lot of the girls. And I got to know a lot of the Indian girls and their parents. One young girl in particular, you know, I knew her, and her father is a very well-known singer. Well, she's doing life in prison. But anyway, I know these young girls, and they were singing this one Sunday. I was there, and they were talking about how so-and-so got a hold of checked out a tape, and it was Christian music, quite Christian music, which is okay if that's how, you know, you want to listen to. But a lot of them said, yeah, I wish I could hear my peyote tape or hear our songs, because our family is peyote people, Native American church. And another young girl said, I come from a Sundance family, and that's our, you know, our way. And I said, you don't have any of those tapes here for you to check out? They said, no. And make a short story, make it short. I ended up contacting the chaplain, and she first told me, no, I couldn't, you know, they had to be gospel or Christian. And I told her, have you ever heard of the Native American Freedom of Religion Act? And I told her, let me contact Oklahoma City if you're not going to allow me to start a music library for our Indian girls. And then, so I won. I got to get the tapes in. And Millard Clark, who is a very well-known singer across Canada and the United States, he ended up donating 10 tapes to start out with, and I put it online, and we ended up getting probably about close to 30 cassette tapes donated to me, which I took to the prison, and I got an outpouring of thank you from the girls there in prison. My daughter is out now, obviously, and she's doing good, but many of our girls are still in there, and then we have different ones that, you know, have been in there, but they were really grateful and really, you know, thankful for the donation, because now they can listen to, you know, their music. And I got a note. I had gone down to Tucson to visit my daughters, and I came back, and I got a note from one of the girls telling me, they all call me Auntie. They said, Auntie, we're down to 6 tapes. They've worn out. Is there any way that you can, you know, get any more to, you know, bring into the prison for us? So this is the reason why I'm doing this now. Oklahoma has the largest population of women in prison. Why that is, I don't know, but that's something else for me to look into and for us to do something about and start working with, you know, more with our young people.
So, Glenda, I was going to ask you, how does the music help the girls in prison?
Gives them more of a connection to home, to who they are, because Mabel Bassett, this is something that we're going to start working on now. As far as I know, they don't have a sponsor for their Native American program that they have in there. So what we're going to work on, and we need to get a chaplain. Right now there's not a chaplain at Mabel Bassett, but I've already expressed my concern to the deputy warden and told her we need to get, you know, Natives in there, real Indians in there to help our girls, you know, where they can identify and communicate more and start doing more for our girls in there, because, you know, it's hard. It's many of these girls that are in that prison, Mabel Bassett, have lost communication with family members. It gets tiring, I guess, after a while, and they get forgotten. And it's really sad. And I also do a Christmas list with some of the girls, because, I'm sorry, this is really close to my heart. But I do a Christmas list once a year, and I try to do, you know, other holidays where I send out a list of the girls that are in there that rarely get snail mail, and we send Christmas cards to the girls. And of course, the list is growing bigger and, you know, longer and longer, because we're getting so many in there. You know, I don't know if it's due to the economy, what it is, but, you know, a lot of our girls are in there for, like I said, different reasons, and it's not my place to judge them. you know, I don't care what they did. It's just the fact that, you know, it could be prevented. You know, these things, you know, if we take an interest, more of an interest in our young people, you know, those are the future leaders of our tribe. And, you know, what are we and what are the tribes doing to, you know, intervene and try to help? This thing here with our girls in there, I stay in contact with them. They write me letters. They write me, you know, send me cards and stuff. And I just try to, you know, stay in communication with, you know, with the girls that are in there. And we're talking about Indian girls from different tribes, not just here in Oklahoma, but all across, you know, the U.S. For whatever reason, you know, they got into trouble here in Oklahoma and were sentenced and imprisoned here in Oklahoma. We are looking for funding. We're trying to, you know, get a group together and do reintegration programs to help not just our young Indian girls, but, you know, the men as well, you know, help them get back into the communities and find jobs, housing, get back with their families, that kind of a thing. This is something that we're wanting. We're in the process of talking about and getting started.
That was Glenda Deer, a Kickapoo Nation woman in Oklahoma who's looking for donations of traditional Aboriginal music for the Native American Music Library at the Mabel Bassett Correctional Facility in Oklahoma. For more information on how to donate to new traditional Aboriginal music on unwrapped cassette tapes, go to BAMOSEDA's website. That's www.bamoseda and click on the Community Bulletin page. You've been listening to BAMOSEDA with Jennifer Ashwasige. BAMOSEDA is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. BAMOSEDA means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at BAMOSEDA.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to BAMOSEDA.